two different topics in the same talk. And the first topic is motivated by beautiful construction of hypergraph product codes by Tillich and Zimmer. And we already heard about this construction in several talks. Basically, it allows you to put together two classical LDPC codes and produces a quantum LDPC code. And this is very, very powerful and very general construction, but it has certain limitations. For example, one limitation is that the distance of the product code is at most square root of n. So to go beyond those limitations, we try to see what happens if we apply a hypergraph product to quantum codes. So we want to put together two quantum codes and produce a bigger quantum code, hopefully with better parameters. And it turns out that this can be done. Moreover, this can be used to prove existence of good quantum codes with low weight stabilizers. So this will be the first result, and it is based on joint work with Matt Hastings. I will switch the topic and talk about the standard two-dimensional surface codes. People usually decode surface code with minimum weight matching decoder. This decoder has many favorable features. It's very fast and it's easy to implement. It can be applied to many noise models. But it is known that it is not optimal. So if we really want to do error correction optimally, we should use so-called maximum likelihood decoder. unfortunately, this maximum likelihood decoder takes exponentially long time, so it's not really practical. what we observed is that the situation is not so bad. And if we are willing to make certain approximations, we can implement maximum likelihood decoder in linear time. And this result is based on joint work with my IBM colleagues, Alex Vargo and Martin Sukhara. Okay, so let me start from part one. So this table shows some examples of quantum LDPC codes that we have already seen earlier in this conference. It all starts with Skitaev surface code. many people try to generalize it to improve code parameters k and d. hyperbolic surface codes can achieve a constant encoding rate. Generalized three-dimensional surface code can achieve distance growing a little bit faster than square root of n. So in this table, I use this parameter sparseness. And when I say that a code has sparseness W, it means that each stabilizer acts on at most W qubits, and each qubit is acted upon by at most W stabilizers. So for LDPC codes, W is some small number. our motivation was to address this big open problem. Whether we can find some good families of quantum LDPC codes. And good means that both K and D are linear in N. Prove that such codes do not exist. We fall short of achieving this goal, but what we can show is that they exist good almost LDPC codes. Almost LDPC means that this sparseness parameter scales like square root of n. So it's at least it's a sublinear. to do that, we generalize the hypergraph product construction in a certain way. And we call this generalized construction a homological product. It provides a very general method of combining quantum codes and building larger quantum codes, which is technically different from a code concatenation. The codes that we construct have a linear distance, it is easy to show that we have constant error threshold, assuming that syndromes are measured perfectly. And we hope that with some extra work, we can improve this result to obtain sparseness polynomial in n with arbitrarily small degree of the polynomial. So this is the plan. So I will first show you how to construct CSS stabilizer codes starting from objects that we call boundary operators. Then I will show you how to combine two boundary operators together using operation called homological product. And then we will see what happens if we take homological product of two random boundary operators. the definition of a boundary operator is very simple. This is just a binary square matrix delta, such that delta squares is 0 modulo 2. And let me show that given any boundary operator, we can easily construct a CSS stabilizer code. And if we start from a sparse boundary operator, the corresponding stabilizer code is LDPC. let me just illustrate this by example. Suppose this is our boundary operator. The size of the number of qubits in the corresponding code is just the size of delta. In this example, there will be 5 qubits. And to construct X-type stabilizers, we just we scan every row of delta and replace ones by Pauli X, and we replace zeros by identities. So we get something like this. to construct Z-type stabilizers, we scan every column of delta and replace each one by Pauli Z. So we get something like this. the property that delta squares to 0 modulo 2 tells us exactly that the overlap between any X-type stabilizer and any Z-type stabilizer is even, so that all stabilizers commute. So we can translate any boundary operator to a CSS code, and now we can ask what are parameters of this code. And so clearly, the number of code qubits is just the size of delta. One can easily compute the number of logical qubits, and it's given by this formula, dimension of the kernel minus dimension of the image. The minimum distance is the minimum Hamming weight of vectors that are in the kernel of delta but not in the image, or vectors that are in the kernel of delta transposed but not in the image. And those vectors correspond to logical X-type and logical Z-type operators. The sparseness parameter is just maximum row and column weight of delta. So if delta is sparse, we get a CSS LDPC code. Now, where can we look for such a sparse boundary operator? And a nice place to look for them is homology. So suppose we start from some manifold. It could be a two-dimensional or high-dimensional. And we represent this manifold as a disjoint union of cells. We can define a linear space of cells C such that vectors of C are formal linear combinations of cells of various dimension with coefficients, with binary coefficients. we can define a linear operator delta acting on this space C. And this operator tells us what happens if we take a boundary of a cell. For example, if we take a boundary of the triangle, we get a sum of three edges, like shown here. The boundary of an edge is just a sum of two endpoints, and a boundary of a vertex is just zero. an important property of this boundary operator delta is that, it is a boundary operator, so it squares to zero. And you can easily check this. Say, if you take a boundary of a triangle twice, we get a sum of all vertices, and each vertex appears twice. So if you work with binary field, this sum is zero. a natural operation that we can apply to manifolds is taking a product of two manifolds. Say if, we can compute M1 times M2, and if each manifold M1 and M2 has its boundary operator delta 1, delta 2, we can compute the linear space of cells for the product manifold, and it's just a tensor product C1 times C2, and we can easily compute a boundary operator for the product manifold. And it turns out to be given by this equation. you can easily check algebraically that this is indeed, but capital delta is indeed a boundary operator. Delta squared is given by this equation. So the first and the last term disappear because delta 1 and delta 2 squared to 0. And the second term disappears because we work with binary field. simple observation is that it's not really important that input boundary operators delta 1 and delta 2 come from some manifold. We can still use this equation to define a product of boundary operator, and this capital delta is a valid boundary operator always. suppose we know parameters of input codes, and we want to compute parameters of the product code corresponding to this product boundary operator. the size of the code is multiplicative because this capital delta acts on a tensor product of spaces C1 and C2. it turns out that the number of logical qubits is also multiplicative, and this is a well-known result in homology known as a Kunneth theorem. unfortunately, there is no simple formula for the distance of the product code. So we only have upper and lower bounds. So the distance is always sub-multiplicative, and it's always at least the maximum of the distances of the input codes. importantly, the sparseness parameter of the product code is sub-additive, so it's at most the sum of sparsenesses for two input codes. So when we compute the product code, the sparseness increases, but only a little bit. let's imagine for the moment that we can construct two families of good quantum codes described by boundary operators delta 1 and delta 2. And in addition, let's assume that the distance of the product code is multiplicative. so far, this is just a visual thinking, but we will see that it will lead us to the right direction. if this is indeed the case, then all parameters k and d are multiplicative under the homological product. So if input codes are good, so K and D are linear in N, you can easily see that the output code, the product code, is also good. So I denote parameters of the product code using capital letters. on the other hand, because the sparseness is only sub-additive, the sparseness of the product code is linear in little n, so it's at most a square root of capital N. So we would get a family of good codes in which sparseness grows only as square root of n, which is the result that I showed you in the beginning. Unfortunately, this first assumption is not always true. In fact, we, in the paper, we construct explicit examples based on the steam code. Then the product code, the distance of the product code is smaller than the product of input distances. one thing we can do is to use randomized constructions. And as you know, there are many examples when we can take advantage of randomness. And this is especially true in the case of LDPC codes, because in the classical case, the first examples of LDPC codes were discovered by Gallagher using a randomized construction. And random constructions also play an important role in quantum coding theory. For example, the paper by Kellerbank and Shor showed how to construct good, showed that if we pick a random CSS code from a suitable ensemble, then this code is good with high probability. And there are also randomized construction of subsystem LDPC codes. And basically, our main result says that if we compute a homological product of two random codes, then the resulting code will be good with high probability. And it will have a sparseness square root of n. I will use some standard terminology. I will refer to elements of a kernel and image of delta as cycles and trivial cycles. Using coding theory terminology, cycles are Pauli operators that commute with each stabilizer, and trivial cycles are stabilizers themselves. And non-trivial cycles are logical operators. I will also use a standard correspondence between vectors in a tensor product space and matrices. So if we have some vector psi in the tensor product space, this is an object which has two indices. So we can think of this object as a matrix. And the first index labels 0, and the second labels second index labels the column. If we fix some parameters n and k, let me define this canonical boundary operator, delta hat. So it's given by this block matrix, and all blocks except for this one are zero, and this block is identity. And by definition, the size of this matrix is n. We can easily compute the kernel and the image of this delta hat, the kernel corresponds to all vectors which have zeros in the third sector, and the image corresponds to vectors which have zeros in the first and the third sector. So the number of logical qubits is a dimension of the kernel minus dimension of the image. So it's equal equals k. So this is very bad code because it has distance one. We can pick a logical operator by putting, say, one somewhere in this sector and putting zeros everywhere else. So distance is just one. Next, I want to define a random ensemble of boundary operators. I take this canonical boundary operator, delta hat, with some fixed parameters n and k, and I rotate it by a random invertible matrix U. And I pick this U from the uniform distribution on the set of all invertible n by n matrices. the first obvious observation is that the number of logical qubits is always k, regardless of the choice of u. And this is because dimension of the image and the dimension of the kernel are invariant under these rotations by invertible matrix. However, the distance is now a random variable that depends on the choice of u. And I will be interested in the limit then and goes to infinity, but the encoding rate r stays constant. And in this limit, we can use a standard result, the quantum Gilbert-Varshamov bound. And it says that if we pick any constant c that satisfies this inequality, then with high probability, the distance of the cot will be at least c times n. And with high probability means probability exponentially close to 1. let me briefly sketch how the proof of this bound goes, because it will be important for what comes next. And the proof uses a very simple first moment argument. So we have this random ensemble of cots, and if we can show that the average number of low weight cycles or co-cycles in this ensemble is smaller than one, then there must exist at least one cot in this ensemble which has no low weight cycles, which means that at least one cot has high distance. by linearity, the average number of low weight cycles is given by this formula, the sum over all n bit vectors with Hamming weight at most Cn. And for each such vector, we compute the probability that it is a cycle, that is, f belongs to the kernel of delta. Now, because we define delta in this way, this is equivalent to this inclusion, u times f must belong to kernel of canonical boundary operator delta hat. If f is a fixed vector and u is a random invertible matrix, then u times f is completely random n-bit string. So the probability that it belongs to kernel of delta hat is just this ratio, size of the kernel divided by the total number of n-bit strings. And if you do the algebra, this is given by this formula. So it's exponential in n, and the coefficient in the exponent is the quantity that appears in the quantum Gilbert-Varshamov bound. So if we pick the constants C and R right, then this quantity is exponentially small in n. Now, we can try to use this first moment argument and apply it to the product cot to prove lower bound on the distance of the product cot. Unfortunately, a naive application of this first moment method fails. The reason why it fails is because by construction, the product cot always has low weight cycles. And those are just stabilizer generators of the cot, because we constructed the product cot in a way such that it has stabilizers with weight square root of m. So it means that at least one step in our proof must sort of differentiate between trivial and non-trivial cycles, between stabilizers and logical operators. analyzing low-weight non-trivial cycles is not so easy. We cannot do that, just too complicated object. we analyze statistics of a different objects that we call uniform low-weight cycles. this is the definition. If psi is a square binary matrix of size n by n, I will say that psi has uniform low weight with some constant c. If every row and every column of psi has weight at most cn. So it says that not only the total Hamming weight of psi should be small, but each row and each column individually should have sufficiently small weight. So we call it uniform low weight condition. And I will abbreviate it using this notation. Let me give you some intuition why this definition is sensible. So basically, if you look on some stabilizer generator of the product code, then by construction it must have low weight, but it's very unlikely to have uniform low weight. Recall that stabilizer generators correspond to vectors in the image of the boundary operator. So we can pick some basis vector, I times j, which is just a matrix which has a single one at position ij. And then we apply this product boundary operator. So they get this. So we must put a delta one acting on I. We must put delta one acting on I in a column j, and we must put delta two acting on j in row I. And although this matrix has a small Hamming weight, it does not have uniform low weight because this high probability delta 1 I has a large Hamming weight, and this high probability delta 2 j has a large Hamming weight. So there will be at least one high weight column and at least one high weight row. So basically, this is the intuition why this definition is useful. And now let me briefly sketch the entire proof. And the proof is rather long. It's more than 20 pages. But here I will try to squeeze it into a single slide. we start from a pair of random boundary operators, delta 1, delta 2. And we are defined by some random rotations, u1 and u2. let's assume that we fix some pair, u1, u2. And then there are two cases. One case is when one of the input codes is bad. Bad means distance is smaller than some constant epsilon times n. And the remaining case is when both input codes are good. So they both have large enough distance. we can use the standard first moment argument to show that this case is exponentially unlikely. And the proof is almost exactly the same as the proof of Gilbert Parshamov bound that I showed you. So now we can concentrate on this bad case. now it branches into two other cases. We have a good case. Then then the product code is good, meaning that any non-trivial cycle has large enough Hamming weight. And in this case, we are happy, so there is nothing left to prove. And the bad case is when the product code has some low weight cycle. And low weight means at most some constant c times n squared. So now we can concentrate on this bad case. In this bad case, we can show that it is possible to find a binary square matrix psi prime of size roughly n. And this matrix psi prime has two properties. First, it has a uniform low weight condition. It satisfies the uniform low weight condition with some constant c prime, which is approximately c. secondly, we can extend psi prime to n by n matrix psi, which is a non-trivial cycle in the product code. So this psi prime has a uniform low weight, and it's a restriction of, it is a submatrix of some non-trivial cycle. then we can subdivide this bad case into many bad cases corresponding to the rank, binary rank R of this matrix psi prime. And then for a fixed rank R, we analyze statistics of binary matrices with uniform low weight. For example, we can upper bound the probability that such a matrix has a uniform low weight condition. And we can count the number of rank R matrices of size n prime that can be extended to some cycle of size n. And then we combine all these bad cases together using the union bound. And at the end of the day, we can show that this case is also exponentially unlikely. And this is basically the big picture of the proof. And yeah, so what I showed you is that there is a very natural operation, the homological product, that allows us to build large quantum codes from small quantum codes. And if we apply it to a pair of random stabilizer codes, we get a family of good codes with sparseness proportional to square root of n. And here I only consider the product of two codes, but in principle we can also consider m-fold product, sorry, m-fold homological product with m arbitrary integer. And what we believe is true is that as long as m is a constant, if we take a product of m random codes, then with high probability the product code will be good. But now the sparseness will be n to the power 1 over m instead of square root of m. But we cannot have any rigorous results on that.
Wait, what happens if we just iterate this construction? So you make a code and you just take a product of one more code?
If you try to iterate this construction, then it works at the first iteration, but at the next iteration, you take a product of one code which is random and another code which is not fully random. It has some structure because it is a homological product of two random codes. So our proof does not apply. Any other question about this? Okay, then maybe I will continue. Yes, so in the rest of the talk, I will be, discuss surface codes and decoding algorithms. And so I will consider the standard surface code with two rough boundaries and two smooth boundaries. So we have just one logical qubit and we put errors randomly on edges of the lattice, and what we observe are syndromes created by those errors. And so our job is to guess the error based on its syndrome, and we only need to guess the error modulo stabilizers. Oops, sorry. For example, this could be one candidate error consistent with the syndrome. And so as you can see, X error always creates syndromes at the two endpoints of the edge, and Z error always creates syndromes at the two adjacent plaquettes. And I will consider the simplest noise model, depolarizing noise. So all errors X, Y, and Z appear with some probability epsilon over 3. The epsilon is the error rate. And importantly, I assume that the syndromes are measured perfectly. So I don't like this assumption, but for now we need it. And let's first consider the standard decoder, the minimum weight matching decoder. And it consists of three steps. First, we look at side syndromes and find minimum weight X error consistent with side syndromes. Then we find minimum weight Z error consistent with plaquette syndromes. And then we combine the two errors together, and this is our recovery operator. And the intuition that this should work very well if error rate is small, because the actual error is likely to be among minimum weight errors consistent with the syndrome. For example, suppose this is our syndrome, then to create these side syndromes, we need at least one X error, and there is only one place to put this error on this edge. When we look at Plaquett syndromes, now we need at least two errors to create these syndromes, and again, there is only one choice of locations for those errors. And then we combine the errors, X and Z errors, together. So this decoders has complexity proportional to n cube. There n is the number of syndromes, of course, n is at most the number of qubits. And this was shown by inventors of this algorithm. But if we apply this to error correction, to the case when errors are random, it was observed by Austin and his co-authors that the average case running time is only linear in n. So this is a very efficient algorithm. as I mentioned, this algorithm is not optimal. Let me show you some simple examples, then this decoder fails. For example, suppose this is the actual error, then this is the syndrome, and we already know what happens if we run minimum weight matching on the syndrome. So our recovery operator is going to be this. So if we combine the actual error and recovery, we get a logical error. So you can see that in this example, the actual error has weight 2, but minimum weight matching can only find error of weight 3.
So yes? Just a note that there is a generalization of minimum matching. You use two rounds of matching, which will correctly correct that.
Yeah, actually, I will mention this in a few slides. Thank you. basically, what this example is telling us is that minimum weight matching is not always the same thing as a minimum weight error. Now let's look at another example. Now we have two X errors. This is the syndrome. it's clear that we need at least two errors to create this syndrome, but there are several choices of locations where we put with those errors. We have choice A, choice B, and choice C. So all these errors are consistent with the syndrome, and we have the same weight too. So which choice should we make? if we run minimum weight matching decoder, then all choices are equally good. One observation we can make is that error B and error C differ by a Plaquett stabilizer. So we have exactly the same action on the any encoded state, and it doesn't really matter if we choose B or C. if all errors A, B, C are equally likely, B or C is twice as likely as A. So we are better off by choosing B or C. So what this example is telling us is that minimum weight matching is suboptimal because it does not try to distinguish between equivalent low weight errors. These drawbacks have been realized a long time ago, and people try to fix this. First of all, let me mention these two papers that basically try to construct modified version of minimum weight matching decoder. For example, this paper by Stace and Barrett tried to take into account error degeneracy, but by including sort of entropy of errors into definition of the weights in the minimum weight matching algorithm. And this this paper by Austin tried to solve the problem with correlations between X and Z errors. So basically, the idea is that we first, at the first step, we run minimum weight matching for X errors, but then we looked at every H, and if we decide that it has X error, it is more likely that it is possible that this X error has resulted from some Y error. And so at the next step, we update the weights and run the second round of minimum weight matching for Z errors. So I hope I have not totally misstated this. and then there are completely different ideas that have nothing to do with minimum weight matching. For example, Duclos, Tsansi, and David proposed a randomization group decoder. And then there is another group of decoders that use Monte Carlo algorithms. And those are basically approximations to the maximum likelihood decoder that I will describe next. but for now, let's imagine that we have unlimited computational power. What decoding algorithm would we use? first, let me introduce some terminology. So we have n qubits, and this is the full Pauli group of n qubits, and it contains a stabilizer group of the code generated by Plaquette and site stabilizers. And we can partition the full Pauli group into cosets of the stabilizer group. We have one coset is stabilizer group itself, and then there is there are many non-trivial cosets. an important property is that if errors belong to the same coset, they have exactly the same action on any encoded state. So what we need to do is just to guess which of those cosets contains the actual error. and if we know the error probabilities, then in principle we can compute the total probability of errors in which coset. if we know probabilities of each coset, we just pick the most likely coset consistent with observed syndrome. It turns out that there are only four cosets. there are only four cosets consistent with a syndrome S, and we can describe them as follows. so first we pick some canonical error f of S consistent with our syndrome. For example, we can connect all site syndromes to the left boundary. And we connect each Plaquette syndrome to the top boundary. It doesn't really matter. and then one of those cosets will be the coset that contains this canonical error f of s. And three other cosets are obtained by adding some logical operator x, y, or x, y, or z. so then we compute the total probability for each coset. And these are just some real numbers that we observe in a simulation. You can see that the X coset, in this example, the X coset is by far the most likely. our recovery operator would be any Pauli operator that belongs to this coset.
Is this the total probability of the coset or just one representation?
Those numbers are total probabilities of the coset. They are exponentially small, but this is just because there are exponentially many cosets. This is just a summary of what I have said. So the input of the algorithm is the syndrome, we look at the syndrome, and we identify the four cosets consistent with the syndrome. we compute the most likely coset, and then our recovery operator is any Pauli operator from the most likely coset. But of course, in reality, we don't have unlimited computational power. So how do we compute both coset probabilities? And I want to describe an approximate algorithm. The idea is that we can express the coset probability as a contraction of a certain two-dimensional network. And we are going to contract this network using algorithms based on matrix product states. And for illustrative purposes, let me just consider the trivial coset. So we just want to compute the probability that our error belongs to the stabilizer group. So first of all, let me define this extended surface code lattice. And this is essentially the Tanner graph. So it has two types of nodes. This black squares represents locations of qubits, and white squares are locations of stabilizers. So if we start from a chord distance d chord, then extended lattice has size 2d minus 1. I'm going to define a family of tensors that live at the nodes of this extended graph. And each tensor has four indices corresponding to four edges incident to every node. And some nodes that live on the boundary have only two or three. Some tensors that live on the boundary have only two or three indices. By definition, the contraction value of this network is obtained by taking a product of each tensors and then summing up over all configurations of these H indices. So the contraction is just some number, and I'm going to choose these tensors such that this number is equal to the coset probability. And so I define tensors at stabilizer nodes by these equations. So all indices are either 0 or 1. So these two choices, 0 and 1, correspond to two choices, whether we pick or do not pick a stabilizer at this node. And tensors that live at qubit nodes essentially encode our noise model. Loosely speaking, let me say that each qubit node receives four messages from adjacent stabilizer nodes, and based on these messages, the qubit node can decide what Pauli error has occurred at it, and then we assign appropriate probability depending on what Pauli error it is.
For the check nodes, we cannot have two of them 1 and two of them zeros. Why do we have all four have to be identical?
Remember that we have to sum over all elements of the stabilizer group. So for each check node, we can either choose this check or do not choose. So if we choose, say, a Plaquette stabilizer here, it will apply Z to every adjacent qubit node. So we can only have all zeros or all ones. So as I said, the contraction value of this network coincides with the coset probability that we want to compute. I'm going to use approximate contraction algorithms developed by these people. The basic idea is that we can think of the contraction process as a time evolution of a quantum system. So, for example, suppose we start from the left column and we contract all vertical edges in this column. So we get a big tensor with n binary indices, and formally we can think of this tensor as n qubit state, psi 0. Then we attach the next column and contract all horizontal edges connecting the first and the second column. Now we get some new n qubit state psi 1, and then we continue in this way until we reach the rightmost column. And at the end of the day, we have to compute the inner product between our final state and the state which represents the rightmost column. And this, this inner product is equal to the coset probability. Of course, these n-qubit states can be very complicated, and it takes exponential time to, well, it takes exponential space to store them and exponential time to do manipulations with them. But the idea is that we can hope that this time evolution is weakly entangling, so that all these intermediate steps have only a small amount of entanglement. And if this is indeed true, they can approximate them using matrix product states. Let me briefly remind you what are matrix product states. If we have a chain of n qubits, we can describe the matrix product states by 2n matrices. So for each site, we have a pair of matrices. And to compute the amplitude of the state for some basis vector, we just multiply the corresponding matrices. An important parameter of this matrix product state is its bond dimension. And this is just the dimension of all these matrices. As long as this bond dimension is not too big, we can concisely describe a matrix product state, we can efficiently compute all these amplitudes. People usually represent matrix product state using a diagram like this, and this basically is a contraction of one-dimensional tensor network. I will need two basic facts about these matrix product states. First, we can efficiently compute the inner product between matrix product states. The second fact is a so-called matrix product state compression algorithm. So suppose this is a set of all matrix product states with bond dimension chi. There is a larger set of matrix product states with bond dimension 2 chi. Now, if we start from some state psi in this bigger set, we might want to find the best approximation to psi from this smaller set. It is known that we can efficiently find a sufficiently good approximation. It's not optimal, but it's often is good enough. The time complexity of this compression is as shown here. So if we have n qubits, we need to compute n SVD decompositions and n QR decompositions for matrices of size 2 chi. Let me come back to this time evolution picture. So we start from our initial state psi 0, and by definition, this state is a matrix product state with bond dimension 2. The next step, we attach the second column, in principle, we can coarse grain this pair of sites and replace them by a single site. Now we get another one-dimensional matrix product state, the bond dimension now is 4 because we have merged two tensors together. Next, we attach the third column, we coarse grain, we merge two tensors together, and we get MPS with bond dimension 8. And if we continue in this way, then the bond dimension is going to grow exponentially. Sooner or later, we should do something to reduce the bond dimension.
Sergey, does the bond dimension necessarily grow when you do this double, or just is that the upper bound of what it could grow to?
Yes, I think this is just the worst case scenario. If you try to do this calculation exactly, I would suspect that it does grow exponentially. But now we can use this compression algorithm, and we approximate MPS with bond dimension 8 by MPS with bond dimension 4. And now we can repeat this process as many times as we want. At the end of the day, we take our final MPS and compute the inner product with another MPS that represents the rightmost column. So we can approximately compute the coset probabilities. Of course, the main question is if we are making a lot of approximations, and how good are those approximations? And we don't have any rigorous results, but let me just show you the numerics. So this plot shows performance of the standard, of the standard minimum weight matching decoder, which is the red line, and MPS decoders with various bond dimensions chi between 2 and 8. So this is the error rate, this is the logical error probability. As you can see that, if bond dimension is true, this is not good enough. This is a very bad decoder, but as we increase the bond dimension, it becomes better and better. And actually it converges, this plot suggests that it converges very fast. So chi equals 6 and chi equals 8 are virtually indistinguishable. we believe that, chi equals 6 gives a reasonable approximation to the maximum likelihood decoder.
D equals 25 is this dimension, distance of the code?
Yes, sorry. So all this data are for a fixed code with distance 25. yes?
It would just be interesting to see how this graph would change if we use the latest minimum weight matching, which does take correlations into account, because that line is going to come down quite a lot.
If we can compare this improved minimum weight matching and the standard one, then we can certainly compare with our data.
But you have a separate tensor network for the X syndrome and the Z syndrome, do you
not? So if you apply this algorithm naively, you have to contract four different tensor networks, because we have to compute probabilities for four cosets. But in fact, it turns out that the contraction corresponding to, logical X and logical Y are almost the same, except for the very last step of the contraction. So we only need to do two different contractions. Yes.
Would it be possible to run it from a much, much smaller distance, like distance 3, distance 5, and then look at much, much lower errors just to see whether the approximations in the MPS approach lead to failure to achieve the full code distance?
Yes, so it's certainly much easier to do it for small code distances, because distance 25 is the largest distance we will be able to simulate.
You should be seeing two errors per. You can detect problems
really quickly. We can certainly do this for distance 3.
Do you think the chi would grow if you need bigger d?
This is a very good question. I believe that if we are very close to the error threshold of the optimal decoder, then we do need to increase chi as a function of code distance. But if you are below the threshold, well, at least I hope that a small constant chi would work very well. Yes?
How does the number of coset calculations required scale if you have multiple encoded qubits?
Okay, so, well, naively, if we have k logical qubits, there are 4 to the k cosets. So that sounds very bad. But in practice, I hope that we only have to look at linear number of cosets. Say, if we use this, if we encode each logical qubit by a pair of defects, then I think we only have to look at cosets corresponding to small weight logical errors, like loops encircling a single defect, or maybe a path connecting adjacent defects. But we never have to look at cosets that corresponds to very high weight logical errors.
So you're saying we can essentially treat them as different codes?
Yeah.
They're like N codes.
Well, they're not quite independent because they might have to look at logical operators like this one.
Right.
Okay. But well, this is just basic intuition. And how am I doing in terms of time?
5 minutes over.
Oh. Okay, then.
It's okay, my talk is short.
You started at 5
minutes. Keep going.
Like a couple more minutes.
Okay, so then I will just try to very briefly go through remaining slides. So it would be nice to compare this approximate implementation of ML decoder with the exact implementation. And it turns out that we can do this for bit flip noise, when only X errors are allowed. For the bit flip noise, we can use simple tricks to express the coset probability as a matrix element of a certain quantum circuit. So if we have distance d code, this circuit acts on d qubits, and it alternates between layers of single qubit gates and layers of two qubit gates. These gates have very special structure. we need only the gates shown here. these are so-called match gates. So this parameter W is related to, it depends on error rate, and it depends on the error syndrome. So these parameters W may be different for different gates. But it's important that any quantum circuit composed of match gates can be simulated efficiently. In our simulation, we use sort of Jordan-Wigner transformation, and we can show that all intermediate states generated by this circuit are so-called fermionic Gaussian states. Any Gaussian state can be described by can be very concisely described by its norm and a certain covariance matrix M. So it has size only 2D. We can compute the norm and covariance matrix for the initial state. We can compute the update rules that tell us how the norm and covariance matrix change after application of each match gate. And it involves computing some determinants and inverting some matrices. At the end of the day, we have to compute the inner product of two Gaussian states. And again, there is a very simple formula for this overlap. the conclusion is that if we have only X errors, we can compute coset probabilities exactly, and the time complexity is only n squared. these are our numerical data for bit flip noise. again, this is a fixed code distance, 25. And here we compare the exact maximum likelihood decoder and our approximate approximations based on matrix product states. And we also have minimum weight matching decoder. And again, the story is similar. If bond dimension chi is 2, the decoder is not so good. But as we increase chi, it converges very quickly to the exact maximum likelihood decoder. So on this main plot, you cannot even distinguish, say, chi equals 6 and chi equals 8 and the exact decoder.
So it looks in that graph like actually there's some points where the MPS is better.
Or
is that just numerical artifact or graphing artifact?
You mean this point?
For instance, yeah.
I think those are just statistical errors because we do Monte Carlo simulations to estimate logical error probability. Okay, and now this way I want to conclude. I showed you, I argued that the optimal decoder we can possibly use is the maximum likelihood decoder. And I showed you how to implement it approximately in linear time and how to implement it exactly in quadratic time for bit flip noise. Thank you.